Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXXV, Lupercalia. That's right, the middle of February is the Festival of the Lupercalia, the time of the year where you smear yourself in the blood of a sacrifice, strip off your toga, take a shaggy thong and run naked around the streets of Rome slapping women fertile? That can't be right. Okay, dress code enforceable. Here's Rhiannon Evans to make sense of all this.
The Lupercalia is a festival in February, celebrated on the 15th of February, and it seems to be dedicated to cleansing the city and encouraging and celebrating fertility. So we're sort of cleansing of evil spirits with a view, apparently, to increasing the fertility of Roman women.
So there's a spring cleaning of the city.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, the February, there's a lot of debate about where the name February comes from, which you'll see especially if you read Ovid's Fasti, the second book on February. But there's a lot of people who connect it to a word that means purification or purging. February, it's also connected to fever. So maybe you want to purify the fever out of people as well.
Yeah.
Ovid, he says it's an Etruscan word for purging. I have to say, he might be right, but it does seem like the default for position for where we don't know where a word comes from, or we don't know where a ritual comes from. We got it from the Etruscans, who used to rule Rome back in the way, way, way back from Ovid's point of view. There seem to be connections to a kind of pastoral lifestyle, so to shepherds and goat herds.
Yeah.
And that is partly through the fact that it's celebrated at a spot connected with Romulus and Remus. So Romulus, the founder of the city, you remember they're supposed to have had this upbringing. They're brought up by a shepherd and his wife, even though they are royalty themselves. So the connection there is that the Lupercal in Rome is meant to be the spot where they washed up near the Palatine Hill from the Tiber after they had been set adrift by their evil uncle.
Yeah.
And then they were briefly suckled by the she-wolf before being taken in by the shepherd. So the Lupercalia, its name connects to the Lupercal.
So this was celebrated on the Palatine Hill in the Lupercal cave. Who's doing the celebrating? What sort of rites does this comprise of?
Well, there are a group of what they call sodales, which means sort of companions or members of a college. They're called the Luperci.
Is this a cult?
I don't know if you could describe it as a cult because there isn't a priest.
Right.
So it's slightly different in character from a priesthood and a cult of a god. The Luperci seem to derive their name, or at least there's a back formation to the word wolf. Romulus and Remus suckled by a wolf, so that makes sense. So they're the brotherhood of the wolf.
Okay, and this is the cave where Romulus and Remus were suckled, so therefore you would do the rites around that cave.
Yeah, exactly. And these Luperci are youngish men, between about 20 and 40, divided into two colleges. We're not talking educational here. The colleges are more groups, sort of social and almost professional groups. They're called the Quintiliani and the Fabiani, who are named after two of the big Roman family names, after the Quinctia and the Fabia. So this is also connected to Roman society, Roman social groupings. So a third college gets added in Julius Caesar's honor, so called the Juliani in 44. It's not very long standing because it's disbanded after his death. The first leader of it was Mark Antony. So Mark Antony was one of these Luperci for a while.
Okay, so you've got these priests, not priests. What am I calling them?
You can call them brothers, I guess. They're a brotherhood.
All right, you've got these brothers of the wolf, and they would be doing a ritual to commemorate the Lupercalia festival. So what does that ritual comprise of?
They act like priests because it's a sacrifice, but it has to be carried out under the supervision of another priest, the Flamandiales, Jupiter's chief priest. And what they sacrifice is very specific. It's a male goat, or maybe more than one, and a dog.
Okay.
Which is kind of horrific to us, I think. this, I guess, is meant to be some kind of stand-in for a wolf. 'Cause you can't get hold of a wolf that easily. They're pretty fierce. Plutarch, who talks about this a lot, he's a late first century Greek writer. He's got this group of works called the Moralia, where he often talks about customs. He says in chapter 68, why do the Luperci sacrifice a dog? So he often starts with a question.
He poses the question and then answers his own question.
Why is this they're this weird thing about Romans and Greeks? And he says, now we do not have to believe him, but he says, because nearly all the Greeks use a dog as the sacrificial victim for ceremonies of purification. And some, at least, make use of it even to this day. They bring forth for Hecate puppies along with other materials for purification. So Hecate's the goddess of the underworld.
Mm.
So he says they took it from the Greeks. I have to say that's Plutarch's answer to a lot of things and fairly unlikely because Greek influence comes in later than a lot of these rituals that you can't really explain anymore.
Mm.
So it may be because there's already a connection with purification that he thinks that, or maybe the link with purification is made because that's the link it would have in Greek culture. You don't really know which way these back formations are happening.
But it's a bit of a, you know, surprise, surprise. The Greek author thinks that everything's been taken from the Greeks.
It's true.
That's just...
We do see that elsewhere too.
That's just stock Plutarch, isn't it? So they do this sacrifice and they're doing this on the Palatine Hill.
So then they lead two youths of noble birth.
Mm.
So two young aristocrats led to the brothers, to the Luperci. And one of the Luperci touches their foreheads with a sword dipped in the blood of the sacrificial victims.
Okay.
It's pretty gothic, isn't it?
Yeah, so you're getting animal blood smeared on you.
Yeah. The other Luperci immediately wipe off the bloody spots with wool dipped in milk. So you can see why purification seems to be part of this. And also milk is quite pastoral because you can get that from sheep and goats. The two youths break out into a shout of laughter. The laughter seems to have been important, that they're happy with this, having the blood wiped off them with milk.
Yeah, sure.
So it seems very odd to us, and I think it seemed very odd to Plutarch as well, that he feels he has to explain it.
Mm.
And then they have a party. They have a sacrificial feast, slaughtered animals, so now they get to eat them.
But that was pretty common, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Don't put this to waste kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly. But a feast is more of a public gathering.
Mm.
After this, the Luperci cut thongs, known as februa, apparently, so a connection back to February and maybe purification, from the flayed skin of the animal. And Plutarch says, this is elsewhere in his Life of Caesar, at this time, many of the noble youths and of the magistrates run up and down the city naked for sport and laughter, striking those they meet with shaggy thongs. And many women of rank, so aristocratic women, also purposely get in their way. And like children at school present their hands to be struck, believing that the pregnant will thus be helped to an easy delivery and the barren to pregnancy.
So this is getting back to a fertility kind of thing.
Yeah. So, and I think that his comparison there is very inept because children do not want to be slapped on the hands, do they? Whereas these women apparently wanted to be struck by the thongs because if they're already pregnant, they think it will lead to an painless delivery, an easy delivery.
Mm.
And if you can't get pregnant, then it will help with fertility.
So a nudie run through Rome.
Yeah. Apparently, I've read elsewhere that they did wear...
They wore their shaggy thongs.
I think it's been often translated as girdles, which is an interesting translation, but basically...
A G-banger.
Yeah, something covering their genitalia, let's say.
A banana hammock, I believe is the term.
Made from goat skin. Now, a banana hammock would have to come over the shoulders, wouldn't it?
I'm amazed by your banana hammock knowledge, but I bow down to your expertise.
I think I get most of it from
Borat.
From Borat, exactly. I'm not sure that's really a great source. Not historically accurate for the Luperci, perhaps.
All right. Why is there a connection between being struck by a bit of goat skin and fertility?
The Romans themselves, I think, found this weird and tried to explain it. So Ovid in the Fasti in book 2 says that it goes back to the infertility of the Sabine women. So this is part of the Romulus myth that when Romulus had set up his city, there were no women gathering in this city. So the Romans, the early Romans, stole women from the Sabines. This is the rape of the Sabine women.
Yeah.
They raped them. They made them their wives. They made them Roman women. But perhaps as punishment for how they had acquired these women, they are early on infertile. This is not a very widespread story. This is Ovid's interpretation. Maybe he invents it.
Okay.
So he says that there has to be a ritual brought in to deal with this. You know, you connect that to the wolf because the wolf has been important in Romulus's life. Connections have also been made to the early legendary history of Rome in another way as a time of this kind of pastoral wilderness.
Mm.
All right. So this is when everything sort of pre-city, pre-civilization, when maybe it was a bit more of a slightly rough golden age when everything was fine and fertility wasn't a problem. No social institutions, no law, no crime and all of that. So it does seem to have this, at the very least, double origin.
I guess that if you've got the sort of ritual where you want to convey, you know, the power of the god, if you want to convey that sort of mythical power and help women out with pregnancy and purification and everything else that's going on, you could either like smear a bit of the sacrifice blood on their forehead, or you can run through the city and just kind of like physically impart it with a slap from a banana hammock. The physical transference of the purity is maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, look, it involves blood and milk.
Yeah.
Both of those are involved with babies.
I feel like I'm trying to, you know, like Ovid, I am struggling to get significance out of a nudie run.
I think it seemed weird by the time of Augustus, by the time Ovid's writing, to the Romans themselves. It was something that they felt inadequate to explain. It was clearly a very old ritual.
Mm.
And like a lot of rituals that you don't know the origin of, it's hard to know what it means. It's also, seems to us at least, faintly ridiculous, doesn't it? And I think it probably did to Ovid as well, having these near-naked men slapping women with these goatskin thongs.
Yes, yes.
Which is not to say that Ovid definitely doesn't believe that it would help at all. I don't want to think of him as some modern cynic.
Mm.
You know, he's very much enveloped in this culture. But it's also hard for him to explain.
Yeah,
exactly what is going on here.
Whereas you can imagine somebody like Marshall doing the nudie run.
I don't know what you think of Marshall. I think he's quite sophisticated. But I guess the fact that Mark Antony participated in it means that it's not something that those who have an awful lot of power, as he does at that point in 44 BCE, look down their noses at, that can seem important and powerful to them.
Yeah, yeah, it definitely had its place. And I mean, if Julius Caesar has his own College of the Lupici, then it's clearly got that kind of position in Roman festivals. So a big source, and there's not a lot, but a big source of what we know about this festival does come from Plutarch, specifically Life of Caesar 61. And essentially, Mark Antony is taking part of this festival, and during his nudie run lap, his victory lap, is he going around the forum? And Caesar's watching it. He tries to present Caesar with the diadem, and this is that famous scene that you've got where Caesar refuses it. That all takes place during this festival.
Yes. Supposedly, the Luperci ran through the forum and the sacred way around the Palatine.
Mm.
So it's kind of all happening in this central space. And I guess, as part of this very public festival, it would be a good place for Caesar to put on this show, if that's what it is, of having the crown presented to him and seeing whether the crowd liked that or not.
Yeah.
Now, as we know, the crowd didn't like it, so he kept turning it away.
Yeah.
But yes, it says something about the kind of crowd that he knew would be there, that he chooses this venue. Presumably he chooses it. I mean, possibly Mark Antony did it ad hoc, but I doubt it. That at this venue, that they see that as a good place to put this show on.
Mm. I didn't realize before Mark Antony stark naked during the crown presentation.
I didn't realize this was going to be such a comedy episode for you.
There's not a lot to make from this festival. Got to get what I can out of it.
It does seem to have been a really joyous occasion.
Mm.
So the word carnival has been associated with it, that it was carnival-like. There was a lot of fun in this celebration. I don't know if they were laughing at the nudie men, as you call them, but there is this idea that it's one of those happy celebrations,
yes.
Right? Not all rituals are kind of joyful. So we've got this in the Saturnalia. I'm not sure we can add that many more to it. But the Lupercalia is one of those fun days off. And that's probably why it survived a long time.
Mm, mm. So we've got reference to it being neglected after the death of Caesar. And Suetonius puts this in the Life of Augustus, that Augustus was one of the emperors who restored it. It must have fallen out of popularity for a while there. but he forbade beardless youths to join in the running.
Yeah, so that comes from Suetonius' Life of Augustus, chapter 31. So presumably this is some kind of attempt by Augustus to instill some moral purity into the celebrations, which sounds like exactly the opposite of what the whole ritual is meant to be about.
Mm.
In that if they're beardless, that means they're very young. So he wants to keep them pure, not have them running around almost naked.
Okay.
You know, he has this whole, at least this veneer of a moral crusade, policing the behavior of married women and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that, I think, fits into that same category.
Okay. And I guess we get references to it throughout the history of the Roman Empire, I suppose, from there on.
I would say Plutarch is one of the latest. Mm. Others are from Ovid and Livy, brief reference in Cicero. We do know that it continued to be practiced. So even though it may have died away a little bit and Augustus brought it back, although I'd say he sort of revived it and tried to put his spin on it.
Yeah.
It continues to be practiced even when banned by Christianity, presumably because it's so much fun from the Roman point of view. And in the 5th century, late in the 5th century, Pope Gelasius I, who was pope from 494 to 96, tried to abolish it completely. He had a lot of resistance to this. The Senate said that the Lupercalia was essential to Rome's safety. So that's how firmly it was held to be important. We do know this. Gelasius then turned it into a feast of the purification of the Virgin. So keeping that purification theme going, but connecting it to Mary. So yeah. Connecting it to a Christian icon.
So Christians are ruining the fun of everything once again.
But it continued to be celebrated regularly down to the time of the Emperor Anastasius, who is in the early 6th century, a Byzantine emperor. And we found inscriptions across the empire that relate to it.
So it wasn't just a Roman thing then?
No, certainly in the Western Empire continued to be celebrated and seems to have been one of the last pagan rituals to continue despite the Christian ban.
Yeah.
And it is referred to by Shakespeare in the play Julius Caesar.
This is in reference to somebody, I guess, being struck by a piece of goat.
It's said to Antony to touch Calpurnia, Caesar's wife.
Yeah.
Forget not in your speed, Antonio, to touch Calpurnia. For our elders say, the baron touched in this holy chase, shake off their sterile curse.
That's very good. There's clearly that knowledge of it during Shakespeare's time. So I guess the elephant in the room that we haven't mentioned at the moment, which I actually thought was a thing, is that this was an early Valentine's Day.
Yeah, so they're at a similar time of year, obviously,
mm.
about halfway through February. I guess you could see thematic connections between that of fertility and maybe turned into a more sanitized version as a celebration of love.
Mm.
But we have no firm evidence that this is the case, even though it's quite likely, and we do know of cases where the church transforms pagan rituals into, or, you know, especially iconography, it makes use of them for its own purposes.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about how there's possibility that the Saturnalia and Christmas are connected. They seem to have a lot of things in common, like present giving. There's less in common here, and there's no direct evidence that we know of to say that Valentine's Day grows out of the Lupercalia.
Mm.
And I would say there's not such a strong, on the face of it, connection anyway. I mean, this is quite a weird, we keep saying fertility, but it's a kind of sexualized ritual and it involves naked people. And Valentine's Day, certainly as we know it now, is a very modern phenomenon, almost certainly encouraged and promoted by the card industry.
Yes.
So unfortunately, we can't really make a strong connection between the two, however tempting it is.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, I have some questions about your lifestyle, but you can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review, keep it tasteful, and as always, they are very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, I'm Spartacus, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.